Jacksonville, WBOB.
The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
Well, they're at it again in the White House. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. I just cannot believe this. Kelly Sadler removed from her job yesterday by the RNC leaker swamp rats. Now, here's a person, Kelly Sadler. She was in charge of the Trump 2020 and Trump administration surrogate communication. This woman did one of the, I have worked with her hand in hand for, let's see, January to now, what is that, 18 months? Unbelievable. She was one of the most loyal Trump supporters in the place. See, here's what happens. If you're loyal to the president and you're loyal to his America First agenda, then you run counter to the swamp creatures that run around the communications department or other places in the West Wing that feign support for the president and undermine him at every turn. Because deep down, they hate the president, they hate Ivanka, they don't like Jared, and they loathe the policies. And they want to get back to open borders and doing things the old way. And they're mad that this president took over the party, basically. And so they seek out and destroy anybody that remains loyal to the president and his American First agenda in the White House. And the fact they got rid of Kelly Sadler is unbelievable to me. And it is really a wake-up call. Because, look, I can vouch for her. I worked for her for 18 months. This woman was one of the most loyal Trump believers in there, along with Stephen Miller and a few others. But beyond that, she was incredibly competent. And she had a huge following. Her surrogates would walk on nails for her because of how unbelievably responsive she was. I would call her up at all hours of the day and night before going on CNN or whatever shows I was going on and ask her various questions on the record, off the record, always responsive. Return phone calls, gave me great advice, always there, put out great work, Johnny on the spot. She was unbelievably effective. See, here was her problem there. She was not only popular with her followers like me, unbelievably popular, but she was competent and she was incredibly effective and she moved the needle. Therefore, she's a threat. So she makes a comment in a meeting about John McCain, which was ill-advised, and which was crass, and which was in bad taste, and she shouldn't have made it, but it was in a private meeting, and she did, and she apologized to Megan. And then 5 minutes after the meeting, somebody ran to the media, a senior person runs to the media, they run to the Hill newspaper, they call up my good friend Jonathan, and they leak it. And the only purpose of them leaking it isn't to protect John McCain. They leak it to destroy her. Leak to destroy. Ah, here's an opening. I can get rid of somebody loyal to the president, loyal to her base, loyal to her team, highly competent and unbelievably effective. Let's get her out. So let's leak this so we can eventually get rid of her. Now, how does the president expect to be as effective as he can be under that kind of an environment? You tell me. I don't know how you do it. I have no idea. I mean, the leaking that goes on in this town is unbelievable. But there's leaks. This leak was done for what? This had nothing to do with John McCain. This leak had one purpose in mind. Take out a competent, effective Trump supporter in the West Wing. Take her out. That was the purpose of the leak. That's why I'm so bothered by it. And for somebody to work this hard and be this effective in the period of time that Kelly Sadler was in there in that position, and to be treated this way in a private meeting, is unfathomable to me. It paints a bigger picture, and it's beyond dysfunction. People say, oh, it's dysfunctional. No, forget dysfunction. It's very functional. Get rid of Trump loyalists. It's very functional. There's no dysfunction going on here. This was a direct bazooka hit aimed at one of the best people they had in there. And until Trump supporters fight back, this is going to keep going on. You just had Matt Boyle on. He told you the truth. There's people in there undermining the president as we speak. They're plotting right now how to stop his agenda. And he's still successful. Unbelievable. Joining us now, Dr. Michael Schur spent the better part of two decades at the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley. He was a senior analyst there, met with presidents, vice presidents, all kinds of people, traveled the globe, as they say. He was overt, not covert. Everybody knew he was there. He was, running the show behind the scenes. And he's a regular here in the John Frederick Show. Now, you can read his books and read his blog. Really good one that just came out. Non-intervention.com. Non-intervention.com. Dr. Schur, welcome.
Thank you, John. How are you doing?
Doing great.
It sounds like it. Sounds like you're growing by leaps and bounds.
Because of you, Dr. Schur. People want you.
I think it's despite, John.
They want you. All I do is they say, well, tell me about your show. I send them your link, and they're like, we're in. So I have to tell you, that's real easy. They want the doc.
That's an unusual situation for me to be in, if that's correct.
I know, right? It is a little unusual based on your history. Some things, though, twist and turn. You know, you never know what's going to happen. As Leonardo DiCaprio said on that famous scene in the Titanic, he said, you know, you never know what life brings. Yesterday, I was living under a bridge. Today, I'm dining with you fine folks in the grandest ship in the world. It's only 24 hours. You just never know.
Right? You just never know is right.
You never know. Speaking of never knowing, so, look, what's the deal here with this Russian collusion? I mean, what is going on?
There's nothing there. And the longer it goes on, what I think it's revealing to the American people is the degree of not only corruption, but lack of any care for popular representation or the American people in general. The FBI, the DOJ, the Democrats have robbed this republic of nearly 2 years of the presidency of a person that was elected by a large margin in the Electoral College, and there's no way to give that back. How do you get? There's no way to get time back ever. But in this case, it's a war on the republic. It's not only a war on Trump. It's a war on the republic, and it's got to end at some point, John. It's got to end, and I hope it ends soon. I have long favored the president wiping out Mueller, but I guess that's politically non-tentative. But I don't know what else to do about it. The thing becomes a joke.
You have your latest column on your blog is fascinating. Let me read our audience the title, and you can read this. Go to nonintervention.com. It says, John Brennan and Osama bin Laden, the protector and the protected, the scent of Arab money, ? And you start out by saying, and I never do this, but this is really something you have to read. I'm just going to read you the first sentence. It says, I have kept quiet about former CIA director John Brennan's ongoing near hysterical tirades against President Trump and the Republicans for two reasons. First, I thought that the critical response was pretty strong and coming from commentators who commands a large audience. Second, I had my say in this space when Brennan was nominated to the post of CIA director. Can you elaborate, sir?
Well, sure, Jen. Brennan has not been welcomed except by NBC, which is shoveling out money for him, and other channels and other clowns like Clapper. But Brennan is a special case. Brennan is a serial butt kisser. That's the way he got to the top. That's the way he got to his position. There's virtually no talent in the man that I'm aware of except the sycophancy. And I wrote that basically in 2013. I said, you know, do what you want to the Congress, but you're going to regret this eternally if you put him in charge of the CIA. The Republicans called and asked my opinion and said they were going to call back and never called. And they gave him a walk when he went before the Senate committee to be confirmed. And now look what we have. We have a man who spent from, in my experience, from 1995 until when I left the process of trying to get bin Laden in 1999, protecting bin Laden and protecting the Saudis, along with the CIA director at the time, George Tenet, Richard Clark, who was the terrorism czar, Sandy Berger, the national security advisor, and Clinton himself. And I'll tell you the truth, John, I find at times I've been terribly naive about these things, and I never put it together. But as I review and rethink what I saw while I was working and seeing 10 opportunities to kill or capture bin Laden given the pass by that group of five people, and seeing contemporaneously now all of the corruption and the enormous amounts of money from foreigners that have influenced, especially politicians on the Democratic side, though I suspect we're going to find some on the Republican side also, beyond the Israelis. It just seems to me there's something that I missed, perhaps naively. Perhaps they're good at keeping secrets. But the best opportunities we had to kill Osama bin Laden were in March of 1999. No collateral damage except for some princes, you know, and the world is lousy with princes, at a hunting camp in southern Afghanistan. And it ended up that the White House, through Richard Clark, warned, it was UAE princes from the United Arab Emirates, and they were hunting birds or something with their falcons. And it ended up that the White House warned the Crown Prince of the Emirates, and within literally hours, that camp disappeared, and bin Laden had been visiting it regularly. At the time, we didn't make much of it, except that Clinton was a moral coward. He had no intention of defending Americans.
Right.
But within a month, a memorandum worked its way over from the National Security Council of a conversation Richard Clark had with the Crown Prince, in which he warned the prince that he was there. And so we had the documentary evidence, and it said, with the president's approval and with the approval of George Tenet. Now, I couldn't get to the president, but I did ask George Tenet, and he denied that he knew anything about it. But so we have the document, and then within a week or two more after that, we find out that the United States is about to sell $8+ billion of a F-16, I think it was, the export version of the F-16. And, you know, I've just been mulling it over in my mind for a while now to say, why could this have been? After we've seen Uranium One, after we've seen the money that poured in from Australia and other governments to the Clinton Foundation, I just wonder if there was some kind of payoff in that F-16 deal that persuaded those five policymakers, decision makers, the ultimate decision maker in Clinton, not to kill Osama bin Laden. And I think it's an important issue for people to look at, because everything that's happened since in the Middle East is the result of not having killed him when we had the chance or captured him. And that's why I raised it. The hysterical noise of the womanish John Brennan is really extraordinary. And it's like he knows what's there. He knows what can be found out. It has less to do with Trump, and this would be fully in character for Brennan. It has less to do with Trump than with his own skin and his own money if he has to go to prison or worse. So that's why I wrote the piece. I wanted to raise the possibility that, you know, this corruption is not new to the Obama administration, and it is across the last four presidencies. And, you know, how can you praise the last four presidencies given where we were at the time of Trump's election? They were all losers. They bankrupted the country. They got us into unending wars. And how do you make sense of that? Brennan praises those people. I think that's kind of reflective of misjudgment on his part, too. But I really would like to know. And there's a gentleman who is a very, very astounding economist and former stockbroker named Charles Ortel, who's looking into all of this. And I've also read that the FBI in Little Rock is looking into the Clinton Foundation. And I just wanted to put it out there in case it was useful to them. It's just speculation, but, you know, I'm too old to believe in coincidences, John.
Why is Brennan so anti-Trump?
Because he was an apparatchik of Clinton and of Obama, a true believer. He's a socialist. He voted communist. He has no concern about the American people or about democracy or republicanism, small R republicanism. He's clearly on the side of George Soros and that ilk of animal. And they're about to get caught, I think, John. It's like a kid about to get caught. You get all kinds of excuses, or you get protestations that verge on the hysterical.
Right. Well, there's something there because it is hysteria. I mean, his former CIA director, John Brennan's hysterical opposition to this president, I mean, he really makes Clapper almost look like a schoolboy. I mean, he just hates Trump so much. Some of what you're saying, maybe that's an underlying reason of it. Let me ask you this. I want to change subjects here. Should the president fire Jeff Sessions, yes or no?
I think on balance, John, I have decided in my own mind three or four times that he should, but I agree with that professor from George Washington University, the law professor, that I thought it was a brilliant idea, if it was Sessions' idea, to hook that U.S. attorney from Utah up with the inspector general. To be able to have both the fact-finding and the indictment process connected in one without a special counsel. I think that is an extraordinary tool because it would add speed to the process. You wouldn't have to get somebody up and running after the report came down. Apparently, they're working together. So, although I lean very strongly toward yes, I'm willing to wait another month or so to see what comes of the IG report, and if it turns out that putting the Utah U.S. attorney side by side with Horowitz, that it makes a situation where whoever needs to be arrested is arrested quickly, and they find themselves facing justice with some dispatch.
They're looking into what, the FBI situation?
Well, as I understand it, part of it is the FBI situation, the unmasking, the Russia situation. I heard the other day that they're even looking at the head of the investigation into Mr. Trump, Mueller. So a number of things seem to be cooking along there, And we really only have to wait till the 11th. They're going to have public televised hearings on the 11th on the IG report. So I think to move before that date probably would be a mistake. If the IG report turns out to be another apparent cover-up of the Clintons' crimes and the attendant crimes of the FBI and other people who were doing their bidding, then I think it's time to really clean house at the Department of Justice, no matter what the political cost.
So the bottom line is you want to wait a month or two to see what happens with the Horowitz's IG report connected to the U.S. attorney in Utah, because they would have pretty...
They could move immediately, I think, John.
They could act immediately, right?
Yes, because they're hooked up together. They don't need any initial investigation. The initial investigation is being done by the Inspector General. And now Huber, I think, is the name of the man from Utah, has been on the job for 4 or 5 months or longer. We don't really know.
Right.
I really don't think we have to wait much past next Monday, the 11th, to see what's going to go on. Within a week, we ought to know after that if there's going to be any action or if it's just another Comey-like transparent lie.
Right. Do nothing. Do nothing. Let me read you a question here from Mary in Williamsburg, may I, on text.
Sure.
Mary says, John, I'm not comfortable with Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The deep state could sacrifice Kim and take out both of them just to get rid of Trump. If you can, please ask Dr. Shore what his opinion is of the safety for Trump in the meeting.
Well, Singapore is not exactly a democracy that's wide open and anything goes. It is kind of an authoritarian state, so I think generally Singapore has a better record of providing security than other people. But you can bet that the Secret Service and probably plainclothes Marines and other people are going to be all over that site. I really think it's important for the meeting to go on. I'm not comfortable exactly with it either. In terms of security, I think it's a risk. But at the end of the day, something that the last four presidents didn't realize was that's what they get paid for, is for taking chances. And I think anybody who would try to argue Trump out of going there for the purpose of his safety is probably going to bark up the wrong tree. But I think he should go ahead and do it, because the situation probably is manageable, unless they're going to try to, you know, the deep state is going to try to take out a city or something like that. But I also like it because he's got the gene, the idea in him that Reagan had when he went to Reykjavik. He's not going there to sign any deal that comes along. You remember Reagan got up and walked away and left Gorbachev standing at the door kind of wondering what happened.
Walked out, that's right.
And I don't think that there's a chance in the world that Trump would act any other way than the president did, President Reagan did.
Right, he's not going to be a Chamberlain wanting to come back with a piece of paper. Neville Chamberlain, if you look at history, he gets a lot of flack for that, and they make fun of him for it. But, you know, if you look at the time and you look at what Neville Chamberlain was trying to do, you know, he was trying to get Adolf Hitler to agree to some kind of a peace process. Not a bad thing, right? I mean, Chamberlain didn't do a bad thing. He just basically didn't read the guy properly, but you know, Chamberlain, as you know, wanted to come back with a piece of paper, and he waved it up and said peace in our time.
I tend to give him a bit of a break too, because his family and the British people as a whole were so terribly scared by the First World War,
right,
that they were desperate not to get into another one, and perhaps that clouded his vision of what was going on. The big chance, of course, that was missed was the reoccupation of the Rhineland, where Hitler would have run if the French army had moved in to boot him out. So
in a nanosecond, they weren't prepared. And also, if you look at German documents at the time, they were fully prepared to do that and fully expected the French troops to come in and fully expected to retreat.
Anything else in that, when the Rhineland was not reacquired by the French, that told Hitler an awful lot.
Yeah, it did. It did. But Chamberlain, as you know, was desperate to come back with something. And like they signed the Stalin Pact, but Hitler did sign a piece of paper that basically said peace.
AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Ron DeRockstra. Before leaving Quebec for Singapore today in a meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un next week, President Trump warned America's trading partners at the G7 summit not to counter his decision to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, saying if they retaliate, they're, quote, making a mistake. Facebook says it did share personal information culled from its users' profiles with other companies after the date when executives said the social network prevented third-party developers from gaining access to the data. Records included information about the friends of Facebook users, including phone numbers and breakdowns, analyzing the degrees of separation between people on the social networks. Facebook says the information was given to a, quote, small number of companies, including RBC Capital Markets and Nissan Motor Company, advertisers, and other business partners. This is SRN News.
Download WBOB's mobile app for free from your app store. Powered by Duval County Judicial Candidate Kimberly Sadler.
So here's a great question. How much would you save if you joined MediShare for your healthcare program? The typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. You might save more. Tammy left a major company and needed a new way ahead for her family. She'd heard about the savings with MediShare, but was wondering about the network of providers.
Once we started the program, I have not had to switch one doctor for myself or for my kids. So all the doctors that we were previously with were all in MediShare.
And she says the process has been fantastic.
I got off the phone and I was like, that's what it should be like. It was a pleasurable experience. An encouraging experience at that.
MediShare might be just the thing you're looking for your family, your budget. Use the savings for other things. Why not get your questions answered? Find out how much you can save. You can call right now. 877-64-BIBLE. That's 877-64-BIBLE. 877-64-BIBLE.
If you're relocating within or out of the Jacksonville area or in need of residential property management or planning new construction, then you need Home Finder Realty. Listing or buying a residential property or planning to build, call Home Finder Realty. And for residential property management up to 4 units, Robert McDonald has a challenge. Shop everybody else, then get the best offer from Home Finder Realty. Call 241-5501, 241-5501, or click hfrjacks.com.
It's been proven time and time again. The best way to keep your family healthy is to eat all natural foods. Grassroots Natural Market in Fleming Island is your best choice for additive-free meats, fruits, and vegetables. And best of all, their prices are competitive with the big box stores. Grassroots in Fleming Island also sells the top brands of vitamins and supplements. Grassroots Natural Foods in Fleming Island. Fresh food, fast checkout, and friendly people. Located by the theater at 1915 East West Parkway. Online at grassrootsnaturalfoods.com.
The 2018 election season is underway. WBOB is your 2018 election authority. Every candidate.
And coming up next, Bob White, chairman of the Republican Liberty Caucus, who is also running for governor.
Every issue.
That's why today I'm announcing that this year will be my last one as a member of the House.
Every day. WBOB, your 2018 election authority. The latest traffic and weather on WBOB, your 2018 election authority.
We've had one earlier accident on the Buckman Bridge on the West Beltway heading southbound from the Orange Park side to Mandarin. That was at one point blocking three lanes. Now it's only blocking one lane out of the four, so you should be getting over to Mandarin a little quicker than you were earlier. A mix of sun and clouds this afternoon, maybe some scattered storms tonight. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high 91. It's 88 now.
Why do we have Curtis on again? Well, we got the whiners about trade. They're all over the place. We got Congress trying to stop the president, doesn't want tariffs. We've got that movement going on. We've got Pierre Trudeau Jr. or the third or whatever his name is. He's saying to the president, look, I've been allowed to screw you guys for 40 years. How come I can't screw you anymore? I want to keep screwing you. What's going on here? We've got the European Union on trade basically saying, hey, you know, this trade deal we got with you for the last five decades, this is really part of the Marshall Plan. That's right. The Marshall Plan. Like, you give us money forever in perpetuity. That's what Marshall did after World War II. Doesn't stop. just because President Trump comes in. And then you got Larry Kudlow, TV Larry, running around saying that, well, it's just a negotiating tool. He's not going to really do the tariffs because, you know, we're all free traders here. We're all free traders. There's not going to be no tariffs. It's just bluster and negotiating. At the end of the day, it's all going to be fine. And then we've got the double standard. And the double standard is you ask the free trading economists, well, what about the $500 billion annual trade deficit with China? And they say, well, it doesn't matter. Trade deficits don't matter. It's good for the consumer. Oh, really? Then you ask the same question. You say, well, what about China? The fact that they have a $500 billion annual trade surplus with the U.S. Is that good for them? Oh, yes, that's great for them. Let me get this straight. It's great for the countries that have a trade surplus, but it doesn't matter for the countries like us that have a trade deficit. Now, I don't know where these people did math, but it certainly is not in your basic middle school, because a 2 plus 2 equals 4, not minus 7. Unbelievable. Curtis L. is going to come up in a few moments. He's going to straighten all this out for us, and we're looking forward to that here on the John Fredericks Radio Network. But first, this segment here live in Washington, D.C., on your favorite show of all time. By the way, did I tell you that I was the Godzilla of the truth in America? You probably didn't know that, so just FYI. But this segment brought to you by America First Policies. That's right, you know, the Korean War, it's never officially ended. The Korean War is still going on. They have a ceasefire, but no armistice, no truce. So the Korean War never officially ended. North Korea has remained a menace since. Despite promises to previous administrations, it continued to develop weapons of mass destruction, nuclear bombs, long-range missiles, and it sold its deadly technology to rogue regimes across the world. It bypassed international sanctions and sold its own people into slavery to finance its deadly agenda. Now, after tough talk and action from Washington, North Korea is finally ready to come to the negotiating table. Leaders from North Korea say the U.S. and the U.S. plan to meet for the first time ever in Singapore. Now, is the head of this murderous regime ready to negotiate in good faith, put an end to his nuclear program, and finally allow the Korean people to live in peace? Call Congress today and tell them politics ends at the water's edge. 202-224-3121. Americans must stand united as we approach this historic summit. For more information, go to AmericaFirstPolicies.org. That's AmericaFirstPolicies.org. This message is paid for and authorized by America First Policies Incorporated. Joining us now, he's a senior advisor with America First Policies. Timing is everything, as the four lines say. It's all about the timing. Joining us now, live from Washington, D.C., just like me, Curtis Ellis. He's been with the administration. He's been in the Department of Labor. He's been with the transition team. He's been in the Trump campaign. He's done it all, and he's with us now once again. Hey, Curtis, good to have you, man.
Hey, it's great to be here, John.
I was really fired up to have you on today. So the whiners are at it again, and I guess the European Union thinks that the Marshall Plan is still in play here, basically saying, well, we want to sell our goods into the U.S. and our cars and everything else because it is the number one market in the world, and we want to do that tariff-free. But if you try to sell anything into the European Union, well, you got to pay value-added tax, import tax, this tax, that tax, it all adds up to about 30%. So there's another massive trade deficit with the European Union as a whole and Germany and the big countries. That's money going out from us to them. But now they're whining because the president says that's not fair. What do you make of this whole thing?
Well, let me give you a little fact here. I know facts get in the way and they're not as much fun. The European Union puts a 7.5% tariff tax on aluminum coming into the EU. We put 0%. So they've been getting a free ride for a real long time here, folks. So they got a lot on their complaining. As you said, we have been using access to the American market, letting all these countries sell their stuff in America as the Marshall Plan, as a way for these countries to build up their economy, build up their middle class. We provide defense to the entire European continent so these people don't have to spend a nickel on their own defense. And they've got their Airbus industry, right? They make their airplanes, the Airbus airplanes. Totally government-subsidized, totally crony capitalist regime, and they compete with Boeing. They sell around the world in direct competition with American companies. So, you know, I really don't have a whole lot of I'm not really crying to them. I'm not really feeling bad for the European Union right now. What's amazing to me is and it's really not that amazing, I guess, because we know these people are a bunch of creeps, is the major media coverage of all this. The CNN now had a up talking about how President Trump has turned policy on, our foreign policy on his head. He's punishing our allies, and he is rewarding the most dictatorial regimes in the world. I mean, this is just pure baloney. And, you know, other more internationalist presidents would be more deferential to our allies. I mean, what good is an ally if they're eating your lunch? Look, we can be, and why do you assume that these people aren't going to speak up for what's good for them? You know, of course the allies are going to complain that they're not going to get the same great deal that we've been giving them for the last 70 years. Since World War II ended, that was 70 years ago, folks. We've been giving them a great deal. And now it's time to say, well, we're going to change the terms of the deal a little bit, because we've got all kinds of people in Mississippi and Alabama and Illinois and Pennsylvania and Michigan that are hurting real right. bad, because you've taken our industries away. We've given them away. And so, you know, it's ridiculous. There's another great story out there. So now Mexico, they're going to hit us with tariffs. They're going to put tariffs on bourbon, right? Well, look, the Mexicans shouldn't be drinking bourbon anyway. They got plenty of tequila down there. They can drink the tequila, right?
What about the
and
pork?
You know what I say? If the Mexicans don't buy our bourbon, that's more for me, okay? Great. This is a good thing.
Now, what about – they also said they're going to put a 20% tariff on pork. Pork.
Right.
And so immediately the Chamber of Commerce and others, Americans for Prosperity, is saying, look, this is really going to hurt pork farmers, pig farmers in the U.S. that depend on these exports to Mexico. And now with a 20% tariff, their meat, it's not economically viable for the Mexicans to buy that. They're going to find pork cheaper somewhere else. So they're saying that's really going to hurt the U.S. farmer and the pig farmer. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, right. The head of the pork council, right? And, you know, by the way, pork is probably, if you dig deep enough, and you probably don't have to dig too deep in the pig pen, to find that pork is subsidized by the U.S. government in one way or another, right? Either what they feed the pork, or how they export the pork, or the fact that the pork is slaughtered at USDA developed slaughterhouses. So, you know, the pork, there's a lot of pork in pork, right? But that's beside the point. The head of the pork council says there's 110,000 U.S. jobs directly related to Mexican pork purchases from the U.S. You know, like, how did they come up with that number? So 100,000 U.S. jobs and 110,000. And we're supposed to believe that all 110,000 people are now immediately going to be destitute, homeless, barefoot, and in rags, because the Mexicans are talking about putting a, you know, 20% or a 10% tariff on pork. Well, look, let me tell you something. Something about farmers. They ought to be able to diversify. If they can't sell pork, well, maybe they should raise chickens. Or if they can't sell their corn, they can grow wheat. They could put something different in the ground. Oh, but what we're talking about here are these giant factory farms that are, like, stretched from here to the horizon.
And right.
They got 10 million animals in there who are being fed by illegal Mexican immigrants, right? That's what we're talking – we're not talking about old McDonald had a farm. We're talking about Cargill had – and it's actually probably Smithfield, which is owned by the Chinese, has a factory farm.
Right.
They're dumping 10 million gallons of pig feces in the backyard. Right. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for these people, to be quite honest. You know, it's like, let's get back to some basics here, folks. America needs industry. We can't just we're not going to all be farmers, and we're not going to all be factory pig farmers either.
Right.
We need farms. We need industry. We need right. a country that has a diversified economy. So let's quit with the whining on from Justin Trudeau and from the Pork Council. It's like, let's pull together. We're under direct economic aggression from China and other countries, and we've got to pull together as a nation and do what's good for all Americans, not just my own little pig factory farm in, you know, that's making life miserable for my neighbors because they got to smell the pig feces downwind.
You know, Curtis, when World War II started, the Ford Motor Company was selling an enormous amount of new cars into Europe, and specifically to the Germans. And when World War II started, the U.S. basically said, you can't send any more vehicles to Germany. Right. I mean, I don't remember Mr. Ford at the time or other Congress people screaming that, well, this is going to cause a problem because we can't sell cars, and it means that, you know, prices are going to go higher for $5 somewhere. They simply said, well, okay, it's in our best interest. And that was the end of it. I mean, the end of their peep out of anybody. They understood it. Now we get this constant nonsense. Here's Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee retiring. He says, while we all agree on the need to ensure international trade system is fair for American workers, companies, and consumers, unfortunately, the administration is abusing the Section 232 authority delegated to the president by Congress. This statement by Senator Corker yesterday, he says, making claims regarding national security to justify what is inherently an economic question not only harms the very people we want to help, but it impairs relations with our allies. He also goes on to say, if the president truly believes invoking Section 232 is necessary to protect the U.S. from a threat, he should make the case to Congress and to the American people and do the hard work necessary to secure congressional approval. So he's got a bill requiring the president to submit to Congress any proposal to adjust imports or tariffs. And both Virginia Senators Kane and Warner came out in favor of it and saying that they were opposed to this so-called trade war, and the president shouldn't have the authority to do this. Curtis, same old story, different day, right? They can't stop the president. They can't stop the economy. So now they're going to put in some kind of a bill basically that says, no, we have the authority to do tariffs. What say you?
These are the same people that voted to give Obama extra constitutional authority to negotiate trade deals. And now they want to take away the President Trump's power to have a sane America First trade policy. These people's hypocrisy and cluelessness is just astounding. But even more astounding is their hubris, their arrogance. They think we forget they bent over backwards to give Obama all of the constitutional power that is reserved for Congress. They fell all over themselves to try to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership that gave away American sovereignty because their internationalist, globalist president, Barack Obama, wanted to lead from behind or lead with his behind or something and let America be last in the world because Justin Trudeau and his dress-up gang wanted to do something different, so we're going to do whatever is best and whatever they want us to do. America is just this evil, racist country or something. I don't know what they were thinking, but Obama had this globalist plan that we're going to dissolve American sovereignty, surrender and do what's good for the global economy, and raise millions of people out of poverty in Malaysia and China and everywhere else but America. And these so-called Republican senators like Bob Corker were right on point with the program, with the Obama program. Now that we have a president that's standing up for Americans, American workers, American businesses, what's good for America, he can't run away fast enough. Little Bob Corker has a lot of nerve talking about what's good for America. He's the guy that approved the Iran deal. He's the guy that brought forth a bill that eviscerated the Senate's ability to approve treaties by a two-third majority. The Iran deal, he said, you know, somebody said, and Corker said, he's amazing. This guy is amazing. He said, well, no, we're not taking away the president's power. It's as if he negotiates a deal with North Korea. Of course, he has to submit that to Congress for approval. Well, excuse me, when Barack Obama negotiated the Iran deal, Bob Corker, you did not require President Trump to submit that to Senate for two-thirds approval. No. In fact, what you did is you wrote a bill and had the Senate pass it that if Congress wanted to reject the Iran deal, they needed a two-thirds majority. So you've got a lot of nerve there. He's lining himself up for a job with, like, the Business Roundtable or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, some fat lobbying job on K Street where he'll get paid $5 million a year to sell out American sovereignty to the globalists. That's what Bob Corker is doing, and everybody knows it. When he appeared with President Trump at a rally in Nashville, the people booed him. They know the kind of joker he is.
Well, you know, he's at it again, and it's, you know, Curtis, it's just the same old story day after day. These people never stop because they don't really believe in anything the president is doing. And look, when you get the Canadian prime minister whining to the president about steel and aluminum tariffs when they have for years subsidized timber and their dairy production, just to name two things, I can name probably 10, just those two because they're so blatant. They've subsidized the timber industry, subsidized dairy, putting Canadian tax dollars into dairy production and wood production in order to drive our dairy and timber companies out of business so they could glut the U.S. market. I mean, and then he's complaining to the president about what authority he's got to put steel and aluminum tariffs on the shipping into the United States from Canada, and they've been subsidizing it forever. I mean, it is just ridiculous. I don't even know how the president keeps a straight face.
He's been doing the same thing with steel. The Italian government, 700 million euros they give to the steel industry in subsidies. The British, 150 million pounds, that's like about more than $300 million they subsidize their steel industry. Germany, 9 billion with a B, euros, and a euro's worth more than a dollar, so that's probably $12 billion. So these people have been subsidizing their steel industry. Guess where that steel ends up? Being sold to the U.S. So they got a lot of nerve. And the U.S. senators, it's even more outrageous that they're more concerned with the German steel industry, the Italian steel industry, the Belgian steel industry than the American steel industry. So they should just STFU.
Unbelievable.
Joining us now, very exciting. A lot of things going on for Trump and the Republicans. Here is Vikram Kumar, and he is the chairman. Get this. He is the chairman of the Republican Hindu Coalition. And the Republicans are gaining, without a doubt, gaining with the Indian community in the United States, a lot of them big Trump supporters that we're very excited about. And he is joining us now, Vikram Kumar, chairman of the Republican Hindu Coalition. Vikram, great to have you with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show, John.
No problem. So tell me about the Republican Hindu Coalition and how this came into be and how this works.
Yes, so the Republican Hindu Coalition was established actually by my father back in 2015, based on the principles of the Republican Jewish Coalition. It's, you know, our mission is to unify the Hindu American voice in Washington and across the country. The RHC group was and the Kumar family was very involved in President Trump's campaign back in 2016, and in fact helped convert 1 million Hindu Americans from D to R, actually. So
tell us a little bit about the Hindu community, Vikram, and why you think there would be a movement towards Republicans. Just kind of explain the whole thing.
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, the statistics show that originally 80% of Hindus and Hindu Americans are 80% Democrat. But quite honestly, if you look at our background and our demographics, I mean, we're quite a conservative group of individuals. One in every seven of us also are entrepreneurs. We have the highest per capita income in the United States. One of the highest education groups, masters and higher PhD levels. So we think very conservatively. Financially we're very conservative, and we believe in Republican causes. It's just we're such a passive community, and till the RHC group has come in and riled up quite a few Hindu Americans, we haven't really risen in the United States, and with respect to politics, and now we're making a difference to express our voices and our Hindu causes, one of which is the strong suit topic right today is the concept of DACA versus DALCA, DALCA with an L.
And so the difference is?
The difference is, so DACA, provides that green card for all illegal childhood arrivals. And there are 200,000 Indian Hindu Americans, children who came here legally. So that's really DALCA with an L is for legalhood childhood arrivals. And we're pushing the agenda, and President Trump agrees with this. We've had one-on-one meetings with him on this discussion, as well as the White House in general agree on this, as do several members of Congress. And it's a matter of on the DACA legalization rule, remove the word illegal childhood arrivals, and that is incorporate legal childhood arrivals. So if you're going to give access to the illegal immigrants, of course, the legal immigrants, those are students or kids who come here on H-1B visas through their parents, maybe at a couple years old. Their green cards are approved, that is the parents, but because of the current backlog of over 60 years, the kid will age out, and it's no different than someone like myself who was born and raised here. They don't know anything better than being, an American. So
basically what you're talking about, Vikram, is the ability for children that came into the country legally under an H-1B visa program with their parents.
Right, so
parents came here.
Yep.
Yeah, parents came here legally to work. Everything was legal. Visas were legal. Work permits, green card. Kids come with them. Obviously, they were not conceived here, because if they were, they'd automatically be citizens. So they come here with them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, come to work. But then they age out. They expire. Now they become 18. Now what? Right? I mean, that's basically what you're saying. It's like, why are they in the back of the line and they came here legally, and other people are at the head of the line and they came here illegally?
Right. So a lot of children of Indian descent, Hindu Americans who were born in India, they dread turning 21, and they, because they no longer become dependents, and they, people make the comment, do I go, jump the border and jump the wall and come here illegally after I turn 21, because then I can get the DACA authorization?
No, right. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Because, I mean, you nailed it. So it's like they can't stay legally, so they could just basically drive to Mexico.